You're listening to Radio Free Thinker, episode 68.
Welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
I'm Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers Club and now officially accepted into the economics program here at UBC.
So all those times you were saying you were an economics student, you were lying to us?
I was being wishful.
Interesting. Well, we have a special guest with us in studio making his second appearance on Radio Free Thinker, Mr. Jesse Bridle.
Hi, Ethan.
How are you?
Thanks for having me. Good, thanks.
And who are you again?
Oh, that's a good question. I ask myself that frequently. I'm also with CFI. As you know, I'm the project development coordinator for the Center for Inquiry Vancouver.
I do know that.
Yeah.
Well, excellent.
Congratulations.
Thanks for joining us.
Someone under you.
Yeah. Well, we should remind our listeners, sadly, that Don and Rob are away today. Rob is off in the UK doing British stuff. I don't know where Don is.
He's doing prairie things.
Yeah. I don't know what that means exactly. Maybe he's plowing fields or being a conservative. So welcome to the show, everybody. We have a great show today. We are actually going to hear from Don a little bit later on. So, before we get to that, I think it's very important to find out, how is everybody doing today?
I'm doing great.
Daniel?
I'm doing good. Just so full of lovely barbecue food from the UBC Freethinkers barbecue last night.
That's right. Quite a success. We had members from SFU and UBC, and we got along just fine.
Mm-hmm. Other than a few problems of us ending up on the wrong side of the beach.
But it's a big beach.
Yeah, we figured it out. We're smart people.
Yeah, definitely smart people. Speaking of smart people, Don has something to add on last week's episode on Is Israel an Apartheid State? Recently in the news, an MP, Libby Davis, made some interesting remarks about Israel. And resulting from these remarks, several high-ranking political people in Canada, including the Prime Minister, requested that Libby step down. So, interesting little development there. And why don't we turn things over to Don, who will discuss that very issue.
Hello, all. This is intended to be a follow-up to our recent segment about the Israeli blockade of Gaza Strip and the Gaza Flotilla. Recently, a local MP, Libby Davies, was attacked by Stephen Harper and Bob Rae for comments she made at a rally held in Vancouver on June 5th in support of the Gaza Flotilla. There, she expressed condemnation of both the blockade itself and the Israeli Defense Forces' handling of the incident that resulted in 9 dead. I first heard about this in an article on the CBC website. It sounded bad for Libby. I did some research, as any good skeptic should, and found on YouTube both a 5-minute interview with Libby and a 50-second edited clip. You can go to YouTube yourself and search for Libby Davies and Gaza Strip, and you should find the two clips listed. Or check out our website at radiofreethinker.com. From what was written in the CBC article and the comments made by both Harper and Ray, it seemed Libby was an anti-Semite who wished to wipe Israel from the face of the earth. I then watched the 50-second edited clip, which only had about 20 seconds of Libby, and the comments added by the obviously pro-Israeli blogger to the clip, and Libby looked even more horrible. Then I listened to the 5-minute full interview, and suddenly, what she said didn't sound so anti-Semitic or even outlandish. So let's take another look at political skepticism. The heart of the controversy lies in a statement Libby made about Israeli occupation starting in 1948. As portrayed in the biased edited clip and implied by the CBC article, she seems to be denying the right of the existence of the State of Israel. Israel was created in 1948 by a UN resolution, a resolution that was also supposed to create the State of Palestine. Sadly for Israel, it was attacked by its neighbors in 1948. In the 1948 war, Israel occupied large sections of land that was supposed to be Palestine. It is also interesting to note that the remaining land that was to become Palestine was occupied by Jordan and Egypt, thus aborting the actual creation of the State of Palestine in 1948. In this context, it is valid to hold the idea that Israel has been occupying Palestinian lands since 1948 and not deny the existence of the State of Israel. Further, to say that land is occupied does not mean that those occupying must pack up and leave. But it is a useful distinction so as to ensure that compensation is made to those who lost their land. Estimates vary widely, but anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million Palestinians were dislocated from the UN-mandated lands in 1948. I could make a parallel with Canada. Our native population sees Canada as occupied territories, but only the most radical would want to ship us all back from where we came. The more practical use the term to ensure proper restitution is made for the damages suffered by the dispossession of land. This is a valid position to hold with regards to Israel and land it seized in the 1948 war, and that thus Israeli occupation could be said to have begun in 1948. We may disagree on the interpretations, but we should at least acknowledge the facts. There's another aspect of this I find funny. In the long interview, she is asked about boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or better known as BDS. This is an attempt by those who believe that Israel is akin to an apartheid state and wish to use the same tactics used to abolish apartheid in South Africa on Israel. For our sake, it is simply a boycott on Israeli companies and companies that deal with Israel to apply pressure to correct its ways. She says that on Parliament Hill, people are, and I quote here, afraid to speak out on this issue. She then goes on to say that more information and debate is needed. There is an implication that there is an overly strong Israeli lobby that has managed to squash any criticism of Israel on Parliament Hill and equate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism or worse. Then, to prove her point, there is this massive overreaction to her comment. Libby's official response, and let us remember, she is a politician, was to state that she was talking outside her knowledge comfort level and that the dates were wrong. Which is also very possible, for in the interview, you hear her repeatedly say that she does not know the historical details and that it is up to the Israelis and Palestinians to achieve their own solution to this problem in the region. She only wanted the Palestinians to know that they had support and that Canadians needed to be better informed of both sides of the issue, something she sees lacking. Lastly, I would like to pull the free speech card. What she said in the interview was not hate speech. She repeatedly stated a peaceful solution was needed, a solution born in Israel and Palestine. All she wanted to do was ensure that the people of Canada were informed that there was more than one side to this issue. The fact that days after her appearance at the rally and this interview, she's being asked to resign from Parliament by the Prime Minister of Canada should send chills down the backs of anyone who believes in free speech. In my lecture on free speech, I pointed out that speech is not only limited or even mostly limited by law. Social pressure does more to stifle free speech and fair debate in our society than anything else. Well, except perhaps capitalism. Sorry about that, Daniel. I had to slip that in. I don't ask you to support Libby's views or statements, but I hope you will acknowledge that they are valid, even if you don't agree with them. And let's try and stop the witch hunts that some extremist types start when someone tries to peel away propaganda from fact and commentary from reality. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on. Back to you guys in the studio.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker. So thanks, Don, for that informative discussion on free
and
speech.
And the snarky comment.
Yeah, that was great. So what do you guys think? Do you think Don's onto something there about free speech being impinged here?
Well, it seems to me that what Harper and a lot of these other politicians who are demanding her resignation or even going farther than that, it's almost backing up what she's really trying to say here, is that debate is being stifled. If simply because, like, you said one remark to someone with a camera, like, next to, I think they were at Robson and Berard, roughly, I think. Just because you said one thing there, everyone's trying to tell you should resign? That's ludicrous.
Do you think it matters that it's coming from the Prime Minister and not, say, someone on the news or just us, for instance?
Well, it seems to me that the Prime Minister shouldn't be telling, like, someone from an opposition party to resign. It seems a little counter to their interests, but I don't know. The Prime Minister should not be trying to use his position to stifle debate.
Interesting. What do you think, Jesse?
Yeah, it's definitely stifling debate, and that's a terrible thing. I don't know if I would equate that exactly with free speech being infringed, but yeah, the stifling of debate is definitely something to be avoided, especially at the higher levels of politics.
Right.
There does certainly seem to be a lot of this in both Canadian and American politics, where politicians are afraid to say anything about Israel that isn't very positive, because I don't know what's happening, but I guess they're afraid they're going to lose a lot of support, and that the parties need support of different Israel coalitions, I suppose.
Well, you know where you won't see debate squashed is here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll come back to more debate after this commercial break.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Jesse, tell us what amazing things the Catholics are up to right now.
The Catholics, my favorite organization. Supposedly, the top-ranking Catholic in Canada is rumored to be considered for a promotion to the Vatican into the Congregation of Bishops, which is an advisory position to the Pope. But he's getting a lot of criticism for that. The top-ranking Catholic is... I believe it's pronounced Ouellette, Cardinal Marc Ouellette in Quebec. And abuse rights activists claim that Ouellette has been woefully, remiss in opposing the Catholic abuse of children, the sexual abuse of children in Quebec and in other provinces. and they're calling for him to not receive this promotion.
Are they calling for him to resign, or?
They're not calling for him to resign, and they're not calling for, in fact, they're calling for more debate, if anything.
Well, the question that jumps to mind, I think Daniel actually brought this up earlier, is if you're, aren't all Catholics kind of responsible for not being more proactive in stopping child abuse?
Certainly the Pope.
And certainly I think there's good arguments to be made that all high up people in the Catholic Church could have or should have done more to stop abuse and to go after priests who are doing this kind of stuff. I don't know if I'd go as far to say as, like, by simply being a Catholic, you are partly guilty, or even being a, like, a, just a priest who doesn't abuse people, you're really guilty of too much. But certainly, like, these high-up leaders, they could have and should have done a lot more.
I take it that this particular leader has had to deal with some abuse cases, not necessarily by him, but by people in his whatever.
Yeah, that's right. Cardinal Ouellette is not being accused of abuse himself. It's merely his handling of priests below him, which, according to critics, he's had full knowledge of and has been silent. For example, not calling for their resignation, not directing church resources to the victims, and you know, stuff like that. Not calling for criminal action to be taken. Basically, your standard menu of Catholic cover-ups and denial.
Interesting. I wonder if. This is a severe blow to Canadian representation in the Vatican, although I don't know.
I don't care.
what would we advocate in the Vatican? Probably nothing, really.
Yeah.
We're never going to get a Canadian pope, are we?
Has there ever been a pope outside of Europe?
I don't doubt it. I don't know.
Yeah, that seems unlikely.
Yeah. I know it's a big enough deal when they have a pope who's not Italian. The interesting thing with this, with regards to the Catholic, what is he, an archbishop or?
He's a cardinal.
Cardinal, being up for a promotion, so to speak, is that Canada, as far as I know, has actually sort of been on the bit of the bad boy list when it comes to organized religion. We've had splits with the Anglican Church, under the impression that, in fact, most of Canada was excommunicated for our liberal views on things like homosexuality and other interesting aspects. So I'm surprised that he was even offered the position at all.
Well, it is just rumored that he's being considered for the position. As far as the articles I've read state, he hasn't actually been offered the position yet. So it is somewhat speculative.
Interesting. Well, why don't we shift gears from the Catholic Church to NASA, who I would imagine don't quite have the same amount of problems that the Catholic Church does right now. Hopefully.
No, maybe some money problems, but nothing quite as bad as the Catholics. I don't know how many people know about this specific mission, but starting about 40 days ago, NASA's Kepler spacecraft has been taking pictures slash video slash some sort of hybrid of the two to try and search for planets in our solar system, or maybe farther.
Solar system? Probably galaxy.
Galaxy, yes. Basically, what this spacecraft is it's basically a giant camera-like apparatus in space that it's different than something like the Hubble telescope, which looks at a very sort of small, precise area. This can look at quite a broad area, and it's looking for slight changes in brightness of stars in order to figure out if a planet might be passing them in orbit. One of the researchers at NASA said that the change in light would be so tiny that it'd be like noticing like a human noticing a fly passing in front of a car's headlight hundreds of yards down a road. So it's very, very tiny changes in light that NASA needs to be looking for. But they've been extraordinarily successful already. In the 40 or so days, they have already found 706 candidates for planets. If that number, or if even, say, like two-thirds of those actually turn out to be planets, that'll almost triple the number of known planets we have.
Excellent. Wow. I wonder if that's going to drastically affect the Drake equation.
It certainly could. If they figure out that planets seem to be more common than originally thought, this could dramatically change sort of our ideas of how likely extraterrestrial life is, or at the very least, habitable planets that, if there's nothing on it, humans will eventually take over once we've destroyed the Earth.
Yeah.
Do you know which kinds of planets, speaking of habitable planets, do you know which kinds this mission is able to look at?
They can look at, their primary goal is to find Earth-like planets.
Okay.
They haven't released information specifically about whether these candidates are Earth-like yet. What they do is they find the basic, or the areas where these planets are with this Kepler spacecraft, and then they have to use other resources like the Hubble telescope.
I see.
Or ground-based observatories. Okay. To find out more about the actual size and other details. So chances are most of them probably aren't Earth-like, right? Just because it would require very specific like distance from the sun and stuff. But there's the potential that one in of these candidates, or one of the many candidates more that they'll likely find, could be Earth-like.
It would be neat to see to sort of get a large sample size and then try to figure out what is common for planets to form. Like, for example, is Jupiter-sized planets more common than Earth-sized planets? That would be, I think, a big impact on whether or not we're potentially going to find habitable, all these human habitable planets in the near future.
I'm sure this study will figure that out at least better than we currently know it. It's expected to take at least 3 years before they can say with accuracy how many of these are planets and whether they're Earth-like. So we have a little ways to wait.
NASA's so slow.
You know what? They're looking super far into space. You try and do that quicker.
Maybe I will. Start my own space program.
Actually, there is a telescope being run out of UBC that does a similar thing called the MOST, which I believe stands for Microvariability and Oscillation of Stars. Run right out of our very own Vancouver University.
Mm-hmm. Wow. This is sort of like the advanced version of that, I guess, where they put it in space, so it's even better.
Yeah, that probably helps being in space. Mm-hmm. Don't have to worry about light pollution or, I guess, drunk students throwing things at it or something. not that people do that.
The controls are at UBC, but the satellite is, in fact, in space.
Oh it is a space
one.
Wow.
Well, from...
But I'm sure this one's much more powerful.
From a quote like from the principal investigator, I really like this quote. It's kind of jarring. This is the most precise, nearly continuous, longest, and largest data set of stellar photometry ever. Clearly not an English student.
Yeah.
Sounds like he's bragging.
Bragging NASA scientists. Ugh. Well, why don't we go to another commercial break? We'll come back, and we'll explain why we played that very bizarre song at the start of the show.
Rah, rah, Rasputin.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we played that rah-rah Rasputin song for a good reason. Today we're going to be talking about heroification. Now, you might say, well, what is heroification? Well, first of all, it's not a word. I made it up.
Yeah, I figured.
Actually, I don't know if I made it up. I just I think it sounds cool.
It's a good word.
It is a good word. So this is the process of taking real flesh and blood individuals from history and through a process of either ignoring, rewriting, or in some cases lying about their lives, turns them into mythical-like beings devoid of things like conflict, pain, or credibility, or even human interest.
It's really dehumanizing them. It's taking away their human elements, their human foibles, if you will.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's found in every culture and society across history. It's done for a variety of reasons, and in fact, it's actually sometimes done even in a passive way, where one person writes a book that sort of emphasizes a certain characteristic of a historical figure, and that book gets referenced again and again, and eventually that characterization becomes the norm. So it'd be like if I wrote a history book about Christopher Columbus, and then Daniel wrote a book about Christopher Columbus and referenced my book, and then Jesse wrote a book referencing Daniel's book, referencing my book. You're just repeating the fact that I've just made up over and over again, and it becomes part of this sort of this cultural meme, right?
Or even if your original book had some criticisms of him, maybe my book left part of those out, and then your book left part of the criticisms I left until it kind of leads to a more rosy picture than actually was there.
Right. The interesting aspect to this is that the passive sense that I just described, it's not really planned or orchestrated. It's an accident of people not being critical thinkers.
It's not a conspiracy.
Exactly.
It sounds like an evolution.
In many ways it is. De-evolutionizing history. But there actually is heurification in what we might consider a conspiratorial way. It has happened, and perhaps by academics or other special interest groups. For example, maybe the descendants of a historic figure who will only fund research that proves what a great hero their ancestor was. It can be done by large bodies like governments or propaganda outlets like newspapers. And it can come in degrees. It can be as innocent as, say, putting a political leader's face on a stamp. Or it could be as devious as, say, a state hiding evidence of a leader's past failings. Now, you might say, okay, well, that's interesting, but why is this even bad? Well, it's bad on several levels. One, it's factually wrong. That's number one.
We like our facts.
Facts are awesome. It censors academic debate and legitimate scholarly research. It silences important aspects of the past that are worthy of attention and research. It promotes a non-critical thinking population that doesn't question authority. And it also leads to a self-centered worldview where your nation, race, people, etc., whatever you want to slot in there, is always right and perfect. Now, and somewhat from a selfish point of view, it makes the field of history boring and robs it of credibility. So, where do you guys think heroification happens more? At the high school level or at the university level?
High school.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. It happens overwhelmingly at the high school level.
High school history, especially as a general rule, sucks.
You're right. what makes you think it's high school?
I think high school as a general rule sucks.
Yeah, I think they have to be very broad with what they say, so I think that it leaves out a lot of the nuances that makes people more human, and often will just sort of leave in, say, I'm trying to think, let's go with Lincoln, like the great slave emancipator, and like ignore the fact that he never really said anything good about slaves and hated black people. Those are like the small details they leave out for the big things, and that sort of multiplies throughout like society because most people don't really take history beyond high school.
Yeah. One of the chief culprits that are often pointed out by historians are in fact the textbooks. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And we can't get into all of them because it's a huge topic on its own. One of the other aspects is that many high school teachers are not actually trained historians. They're just trained educators. And there's also this notion, and I'm going to put this in quotation marks, that high school students are, quote unquote, difficult to teach, which I generally chalk up to the laziness on the part of the educator to not try to engage students. And of course, there shouldn't be ignored the powerful industry that has emerged around high schools and, I guess, primary schools as well, the school boards that are dominated by parents and lawyers and educators who primarily just don't want to offend anybody.
Yeah, or in some cases, like Texas, maybe offend people.
Yeah, we don't care. We just want to make sure that our views are more important than other people's views.
Which we've talked about Texas a couple times.
We'll talk about Texas a few times today as well. To illustrate sort of the demarcation line between high school and university, no other field of academia actively has to reteach material the way college or university history professors have to do with students fresh out of high school. To quote James Lowland, the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, indeed, history is the only field in which more courses high school students take, the stupider they become. Which is quite horrible for history and the study of history. Now, I'm going to talk about a few examples of purification. One of my favorite examples is Thomas Jefferson. He's mostly known for being the third president of the United States, the author of the Declaration of Independence, and is considered one of the most important political figures in American history, or even history of democracy.
His face is on Mount Rushmore.
That's true.
How can you really argue with that?
That's right.
60 feet tall.
And he's on the $2 bill.
That's true, yeah. Really, $2 bill.
Yeah.
They have a $2 bill?
They kind of shortchanged
him. Okay. Well, so Jefferson is often considered to be a man of the Enlightenment. I mean, that's what you kind of think of with Jefferson, right?
Of course.
He wrote Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness. Unfortunately, at the time when he wrote that, he owned 175 slaves.
So really, it was Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, comma, for some.
White men. And, yes. then they added some taglines to that down the road. Now, history textbooks frequently gloss over this paradox. They either don't mention it, or they point it out after pages of praise for Jefferson and give it no real context. Sometimes they provide very wishy-washy explanations like, well, Jefferson was in debt and he needed the slaves to make back money, which is just a lie. He was very, very wealthy. He owned a mansion that he built to look like a Greek palace.
Well, he did die with debt, so there's something to that, although it's not necessarily a good excuse for someone who truly...
Well, I'm sure that when Bill Gates dies, he's going to have credit card debts. I mean, like...
But...
Why not?
I mean, if you look at Jefferson, it's a little more nuanced than what you're saying, too. It's certainly not what history textbooks are saying, but he supported lots of people who believed in the free state doctrine, that any new state should be free of slaves.
Well, that's not exactly true either, but I'll get to that in a moment. I think it's important to clarify, though, that Jefferson, not only did he keep slaves, but he was not an enlightened slave master. He was known to beat his slaves, he was known to hire bounty hunters to track down escaped slaves, and he was known to sell slaves to the Deep South as punishment. And in fact, before he died, he did advocate extending slavery to the Western territories. So he wasn't really even considered remotely hostile to the slavery movement. And there is this kind of paradoxical debate going on that, well, was Jefferson maybe an abolitionist at heart, or was he, you know, didn't really care all that much? And if you read some of the actual documents that Jefferson wrote, particularly Notes on the State of Virginia, which is actually one of the most racist documents ever written, I think you'll notice that he's not really in favor of stopping slavery. If he does say that he wants to stop slavery, it's more likely he wants to because he wants the black people to go away. He wrote frequently about, quote-unquote, scientific ways to prove that white people are superior, black people are inferior. And you can also imagine that he didn't think too highly of Native people as well.
Mm. He certainly wasn't a great person when it comes to that.
No, he wasn't.
But at the same time, you have to look at it slightly pragmatically. The U.S., the South and the North were already starting to gear up towards the eventual Civil War, even though I hate using that term. But... And he wanted to keep them together. And one of the things that the South hated was the North trying to say they'd outlaw slavery in the South. Now, as horrible as slavery is, we should keep in mind that some of this stuff he probably did to try and stop a civil war from starting. Or to try and keep the U.S. together.
Possibly.
It doesn't mean he's a wonderful person.
No.
Like some people say, but he's not necessarily this evil slave beater, horrible man.
Although, by what I just read, it makes him sound like he is. The popular image of Jefferson is often the shape of a conflicted man who constantly wrestling with this concept of slavery, and he was kind of cruelly born into an age of racism and lacked the ability to change the culture of America, which I think is kind of completely and utterly ridiculous, because he did change the culture of America. He changed the culture of the world, practically. So the idea that this guy who changed the face of democracy couldn't extend his ideas of enlightenment to a different segment of the population, I think does speak quite volumes about his character. Now, what Daniel was getting at, though, however, is quite apt as well. Just because a character is somewhat, well, awful, doesn't mean that his contributions to history are not important as well. I'm not saying let's stop talking about Thomas Jefferson forever, but by not talking about his negative points, we deny the option to debate or to place into context this important character of history. And I want to talk about one other aspect here, and this is quite nefarious, I think. This is an example of state-sponsored pseudo-history. The Jefferson Memorial. On its third panel is a poorly collected series of quotes taken from many different sources and amalgamated together to make it sound like Jefferson is condemning slavery. In fact, if you take in context the quotes, they're actually promoting slavery. They've been spliced apart, sewn together to create this version of Jefferson that is just not true.
Well, awesome. Go whoever made the Jefferson Memorial.
Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate.
When was it set up, do you know?
Long ago. I know that it's been continually tinkered with for a number of years, but it is quite glaring. And it's not like this is like secret information. It's like anyone can figure this out by reading Jefferson's actual works. Mm-hmm. So it's not like sneakily done. It's poorly sneakily done what it is.
His words definitely can be jarring between one and the other, where he'll be like he'll condone slavery in one, and then in the next we'll be talking to someone else and be saying that slavery is a horrible institution.
Right.
Although he definitely, and there's no real reason to debate this, ever thought that free black people should be living equal with Americans. He never ever said anything like that.
Yeah. Now, it's important to recognize that heroification is not limited to America. This process of ignoring history and emphasizing other parts, it typically coincides with nationalist, patriotic, or racist ideas, and that's pretty much anywhere. In Canada, for instance, we have to look no further than the residential school system. It's talked about fairly often now, but until very recently, it wasn't. It was one of those inconvenient facts of Canadian culture and history that we just didn't really like, didn't sync up with the notion of what we wanted to think of ourselves. And unfortunately, I think it's kind of disingenuous to do that. I think we need to confront the aspects of ourselves that make us uncomfortable. And we need to have this debate with our people that we're trying to educate. Otherwise, I think that we're kind of, well, we're playing a very dishonest and fast and loose with the facts.
Sorry, go on, Jesse.
I was just going to ask if you think the opposite, vilification of historical figures, is as much of a problem or maybe more of a problem as the heroification?
It can be. Typically, vilification is often done by another group of people. So you might get like vilification of Soviet leaders in America or American leaders in Russia.
I think the U.S. is the perfect example of this internally between like with the left and the right. Like the left here are like saying someone's a hero while the right saying like their villain, like Roosevelt,
yeah,
sort of often a hero of the left, but also a hated person of the right. And so you sort of get both sides of the coin there for a lot of U.S. presidents.
And I mean, when we were talking before about Texas, when they were banning Thomas Jefferson, you know, that's just as bad as ignoring the bad parts of Thomas Jefferson's life. I mean, you want to ultimately give a rounded picture of the man, and you want it to be clearly clearly demonstrated in the textbooks and popular culture. I think that both extremes are ultimately horrendous.
Yeah, very, very few people are truly saintly.
Yeah, I don't think anyone is saintly, actually.
Not even Mother Teresa.
Especially not Mother Teresa. but anyway, getting on to another Canadian example, I wanted to talk a bit about one of our prime ministers, William Mackenzie King, who was our 10th prime minister. And he's often sort of characterized as one of the most important prime ministers in Canadian history. And in fact, he was one of the most important prime ministers in Canadian history.
He was, I think, the longest-serving prime minister in Canadian history, if I remember correctly.
I believe so, yes. He was also our wartime prime minister. He was also very responsible for the growing leaps and bounds of Canadian autonomy as well. But what's not talked about all that often is Mackenzie King's admiration of Adolf Hitler, his association with prostitutes, and his obsession with mysticism, fortune-telling, and mediums, which I think is kind of interesting as a skeptic. It's like,
sure,
you know. Now, all of this could legitimately file under irrelevant, as long as Mackenzie King didn't let them interfere with his duties as prime minister.
Well, I think certainly admiring a political leader of another country is definitely going to affect what you do foreign policy-wise.
Yeah.
Especially during a war with that country.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think he distanced himself once the war started, but
he sure did, so. Sort of.
But before that, he definitely bought into Nazi propaganda.
Exactly. But which is not to say most leaders at the time did, actually.
Yeah.
Hitler was actually very well respected before the war, for some reason. Mm. What I find less excusable, and despite the fact that it's very never mentioned, is he was quite the distasteful anti-Semite. And in fact, King and his Minister of Immigration, Frederick Blair, were quite notable in their attempts to block Jewish immigration into the country during World War II. And the most notorious case is the story of the St. Louis, which was a German boat that tried to transport 900 Jewish refugees fleeing Nazi persecution. And they were denied entry by Cuba, the U.S., and then Canada. And there's quite a sad story that goes along with the Herculean efforts of Frederick Blair to block any refugees getting off this boat into Canada. I mean, the really tragic part was that they went back to Europe and most of them were killed. So, you know, again, not to say that, look what King did, let's ban him from history, but let's examine this.
Let's be skeptical.
Let's take this into context. I mean, you know, it's too easy to say what a great man King was. It's a lot harder to say, well, he did some good, but on the other hand, he was actually kind of a jerk. So we got to put these two things together and be skeptical. Exactly. Now, like we were talking about, the main goal is not to do the opposite and vilify historic figures. No one is perfect. And when we use current views on ethics and morality, when we look back on figures who lived decades or even hundreds of years ago, we're going to see discrepancies. So the goal should not be to retrospectively make up facts about figures so they sync up with our concepts of morality, but rather to allow their lives to inform us, guide us in our own concepts of morality.
Yeah, you don't have to completely condemn someone in the past for having a view of morality that you would no longer support or is generally no longer supported, but at the same time, shouldn't ignore it.
Exactly. Well, why don't we take a break, go to a commercial break, and we'll come back with a bit more on heroification.
What might one hear when listening to an episode of Mondo Trash Show with Maxwell on CITR 101.9 FM?
I love you so much, Madonna.
Sundays at 9 o'clock in the evening.
And that's why I'm going to kill you.
Sundays at 9 o'clock in the evening.
Look at this muscle, man. Oh, God, it's so beautiful.
I'm calling the police now!
Hey, I'm Maxwell, and every Sunday at 9 p.m. on CITR, I play electro and indie rock, and I give away free concert tickets, and you should totally listen, because it's pretty cool.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. We're talking about heroification, and I also want to talk about how heroification does not necessarily have to be about people. It can actually be about events or places or anything, really.
Groups of people.
Groups of people. A great case is the Alamo. It's a you know what the Alamo is, of course, right?
Back to Texas.
Yep. Yeah. The Alamo is a case where facts have become clouded by popular culture. There's a really good example. The case of William Barrett Travis, who was in charge of the Alamo, who, quote-unquote, drew a line in the sand when it appeared that the Alamo's defenders had only two choices, flee or fight to the death. In the popular narrative, of course, everybody steps across that line. Except, of course, for the one man who conveniently survived to tell the story. So, events themselves can be turned into superhero movies, or they can be downplayed, or they can be completely shifted around to shift blame, to shift responsibility. Another good example is the Haitian Revolution, which is hardly ever talked about, even though it was an extremely important event in the history of North American politics.
Isn't that where they made a deal with the devil?
Yeah, according to a few American pundits. Another good example is Thanksgiving. You know, very strange way we talk about Thanksgiving in these days. For example, even a country's motivations for entering war. The British Empire had quite an interesting way of justifying how they entered wars. It was always to defend liberty and justice, sometimes, or to stop people from getting liberty and justice. So
whatever worked for them at the time.
Exactly.
Another one that I will say is the Olympics.
Sure, sure. Sports figures typically are lauded with praise far extending to what they actually do in reality. So why does heroification actually happen? Now, there's really no easy answer to this question. There's a popular theory among sociologists, which is known as critical theory, that would argue that this is an example of the power elite controlling the past. As George Orwell pointed out, who controls the present controls the past. The central argument is that since textbook manufacturers are ultimately owned and controlled by the same media moguls who also own and control newspapers, TV stations, and powerful lobby groups, textbooks will ultimately be made to produce a non-critical thinking students who don't question authority. Now, this argument, while maybe seductive, doesn't really hold up. After all, if the elite are so powerful, why haven't they crushed the criticism and articles that expose their control over education? Critical theory can't seem to explain why it's so popular. It not only does it dominate the field of sociology, but books that are published about critical theory become very popular, and they're popular with educators and lay people alike. So if the power elite are so powerful, they're not really all that intelligent. Now, we can say that maybe the upper class controls publishing, but they don't seem to control content. I think the blame ultimately comes down more, not all, but more, on the special interest groups that control textbook regulations. Now, we've talked about this before with science textbooks, but to recap, school boards generally decide which textbooks they use. These school boards are typically made up of teachers, parents, lawyers, and lobbyists. The manufacturers of these textbooks have learned to make their textbooks acceptable to the biggest and largest markets as opposed to tailor-making books for each individual school board. So in the U.S., that's Texas and California, which is why Texas is such a frequent subject on our show. Now, there's also a cultural question. That is, what do we want to teach people? And there are roughly two schools of thought on this. One is to teach students to inspire them, to love their nation, to tell truth in an optimistic way, and to impart moral lessons. There's another theory that suggests we should confront students with important questions with no cut and dry answer, to focus research on specific problems in society and to use a variety of different sources to explain these problems. What we come back to is the notion of what we want our history to do. Do we want it to inspire, or do we want it to educate?
Well, above all, I think it has to be true.
Right.
No matter what the goal is, you can't go spreading falsehoods in the name of inspiring people.
That's right. And for a long period of time, that did seem to be the style. It was, well, doesn't really matter if it's made up. We want it to be true.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even go as far to say it's made up. It's just very select. It's very selective in what it chooses mm-hmm. to tell people, especially these really broad history textbooks or other kind of broad textbooks. They leave out a lot of the nitty gritty and leave the very basics.
Exactly.
Which can be misleading.
And the power of culture is not to be underestimated. I mean, you can try to explain people the real story behind Christopher Columbus. You know, one quote-unquote fact that he was born in Genoa, which is debated, or that he's Italian, which is not true because Italy didn't exist back when he was born, or that he thought the world was round and wanted to prove it by sailing around, which there's no evidence for this at all, or that he was looking for a passage to India, which is, there's no evidence for that at all either, and that he discovered the West Indies, which you can't because people were living there already. And Columbus was quite sure of that because he enslaved a couple of them.
Well, he discovered it for himself.
Yeah, and then
he didn't know about it.
Yeah. Now you can try to explain this to people, but they don't want to hear it. They want the story of Columbus to be this mythical story of this hero who makes them feel good about themselves. And it's very difficult to convince somebody that, you know, that's really not a good way to look at the world or really reality. And I think that's kind of a battle that skepticism has been having for a very long time, that it's not really good to have this sort of rosy-tinted, wonderful view of the world, when in fact it's actually quite harmful in some cases.
Mm-hmm. The world is not always that wonderful.
And to close this segment, I want to say that when heroification is done, it robs historical figures or events of their credibility. It turns ordinary people like Thomas Jefferson into Superman. And it turns events like the Alamo into a Hollywood movie. And which is fine for Hollywood movies and comic books. But when we try to teach people about our past, about where we came from, it's important that they know about the bad things too. Not only the bad things, only the good things. Both. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like that quote in Shakespeare where he says, "Tell my tale truthfully, the good and the bad, the people make up their own minds."
I think telling people the good and the bad, especially political history, would lead to people being very, very, very pessimistic about politics.
Yeah.
Not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but I can see why people fear really looking into these things, because if you go back to most sort of major political changes, let's just stick with politics here, if you look hard enough, you're going to see lots of backroom working for people working for their own interests or silly ideologies, and it's not necessarily the rosy picture you get in textbooks of one man fighting for justice.
Well, I mean, from a historian's point of view, I mean, human history is kind of one big crap fest of horrible events leading to other horrible events. And the sad truth is, though, I mean, we want to find hope and salvation in our stories, when in fact, very few actually have hope and salvation in our stories. They're usually, what can we get away with, you know, doing to somebody? And I think the important way to sort of phrase that to students, and anyone really, is look at how we've changed. In certain regards, we haven't changed all that much, but in many other regards, we have. And again, Thomas Jefferson wrote some pretty fantastic things, and that can't be ignored, what he wrote. And if we were to take maybe not the spirit of what he wrote, but actually the words, and put them into practice, you might get a far more positive view of politics and history.
In a way, that can be a lot more inspirational as well, because when you look at people as heroes, that's not something that you think is possible for yourself. You think, I'm just a person. What can I, you know, how could I ever compare to a hero like Thomas Jefferson? But when you look at Jefferson as just a man with, you know, good and bad, you think, well, regular people can do wonderful things too. And it I don't know, maybe it could inspire people to strive for doing heroic things themselves while still trying to minimize their own bad stuff.
And alternatively, I think if you look at it and realize that most people who are seen as villainous in history are quite human too, and all of us could potentially fall towards that as well. They aren't sort of these separate humans like it's often said, like, Hitler, as horrible as he was human.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, when he wasn't murdering Jews, he was playing with children. And it's sort of this thing that's often covered up because people, no one wants to think they could be like Hitler, but it's a possibility that we need
absolutely.
To confront.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a cautionary tale in many ways, you know. Hitler was human. Some of the worst crimes committed, well, actually, all the worst crimes committed were done by humans. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be confronted. And, well, I mean, I think we're all on the same page on this. I'd be curious to see what our readers think, our listeners think. We have readers, too, on the blog. You can email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. We are running out of time, so we might want to go to our skeptical highlights. I have a few incredible CFI events that are coming up.
Incredible.
They're incredible. One of them is a talk by Dale Jackman, and his talk is entitled Science and Medicine Under Attack, Why Religion and Politics is Dangerous. And that is on Friday, June 25th at SFU Harbor Center. You can check out our webpage at www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver.
That talk sounds really interesting.
Yeah, Dale is a really neat guy. I'm unfortunately not going to be there because I'll be in the CFI Leadership Conference in Buffalo, but I hope it's taped so that I can watch it later. The other great event that's coming up that I'm also really excited about is we are launching a brand new Skeptics in the Pub in Richmond, Monday, June 28th at the Legends Pub. It's going to be the last Monday of every month for the summer, so come by to Legends Pub and check us out. It's going to be lots of fun.
If I remember correctly, Legends Pub is right off the Canada line, too.
It's like not even 5 minutes away.
Exactly. So you have no excuse.
No excuse. Jesse, you were mentioning something about Science World.
Yeah, actually, this came through on Facebook, on Science World's Facebook page. They're planning an expansion, an outdoor science park in front of Science World. And if you'd like to have some say on exactly how that's done, they're holding 3 open houses to discuss plans and take feedback from the community. The first one is on July 5th. That's at the Mount Pleasant Community Center. The second one is the next day, July 6th, at Science World itself. And then on July 8th, at the Vancouver Public Library. They all start at 4 o'clock and go until 8 p.m. And you can find more information at scienceworld.ca/switch.
Excellent. We'll have links to that on our webpage at www.radiofreethinker.com. Remember that you can become a fan on Facebook, and you can read our blogs at our webpage and follow us on Twitter and all that social networking stuff. So please do so. And remember to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And if you're not too busy, leave a positive or really negative review. Those do get read by people.
And don't forget to send us email. We love email.
We really do. We really
do. It keeps us going.
Yeah. We're very sad, lonely people. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me here, too.
And this is Daniel, saying thanks for listening.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math,